That's on harvesters' form agreements?
Yes, sir. Chief Justice, what's important about this is not, there's something more important about this. When this was drawn up, the relationship had already been in place for 17 years, and Harvester was not only looking forward, they were defining a relationship that had 17 years of history behind it. When they repeated that language in 1964, they were not only looking forward, they were characterizing, in their own words, the dictionary definition of a fiduciary relationship that at that time had existed for 21 years. And in 1979, the agreement that they breached, they were not only looking forward in perpetuity, as their contract said, forever and ever, so long as you don't violate this contract. They were looking back to 36 years of history between those parties. And when Harvester looked back in this agreement, they called it the dictionary definition of a fiduciary relationship.
The Court of Appeals held that no fiduciary relationship existed and rendered judgment against you on that basis. I take it the Court of Appeals must have concluded then either that the non-existence of the relationship was established as a matter of law or that there was no evidence from which the jury could find such a relationship.
They found no evidence, Your Honor, and we say that that was obviously wrong because of the harvester's own writings.
They also found that if there was evidence, it was insufficient.
I'd like to address that.
But that would entitle you to a remand if that finding was accurate.
As we all know, certain of us continue to pay the price for the versus Ford Motor Company in the Texas County Court. The entire analysis of the Texas County Court in this strike, this court, the standard of review is the fact that according to the large length relationship has continued for a long period of time, not that won't create a fiduciary relationship between the parties. Bam. Under the present circumstances, we hold no informal fiduciary relationship existing. Then they say, our further review of the evidence reveals that the evidence is insufficient under the review standard, Poole versus Ford. So if we're wrong, then we've already done our Poole analysis and that's it in that one sentence. You'll not find any other systematic review of the evidence of insufficient support in that sentence right there.
So at a minimum, it goes back to the CA for a proper Poole analysis.
Yes, sir. I think you either find it established as a matter of law, or you send it back to them and say, no, we understand you pay lip service to Poole, but we think y'all really analyze it. I think that's the gut of it.
Are you suggesting that this kind of arrangement it always involves fiduciary relationship or the duty of good faith and fair deal?
I don't take that position. I understand that the amicus does, and I think it may be a point well taken, and I think that you may use this case to decide that issue in Texas. But I think for my client's sake, my client's members of the public too, and on the particular facts of his case, we proved it. As a matter of law, there was no contrary evidence to dispute Harvester's own right.
Well, the informal confidential relationship, though, that depends on some fact finder determining that there is a special element of trust that causes one party to relax its own diligence.
And the jury did that.
I cannot fathom. That sounds like establishing negligence or gross negligence as a matter of law.
But, Your Honor,
the jury already entitled to disbelief.
If you agree with me that I introduced what is an admission of International Harvester repeated three times over 43 years, and they don't come forward to offer a single iota of evidence to overcome what I have offered, I'm entitled to have that as found as a matter of law. It's within their power to overcome the legal presumption that I can create by their admissions. And they didn't do that. And they make no complaint that the judge cut them off from doing that to trial court. Now, because the writ has been granted, our writ was granted as a writ, Harvester was granted because there are some elements in there about damages that also need to be addressed. I will tell the court frankly that I think the Texas County Court could go back at some point and write a point on the damages for loss of profits, and that's the only thing they have a chance to hold up. But I would urge the court, if you're going to send this case back, look at those damage elements. They did the same thing in the pool analysis on insufficiency of the evidence on the other elements of damage that they did on the fiduciary relationship. And I'm going to yield my time now to the amicus because somebody may spend more time on that, but you need to look at the damage elements too. They've done the same thing in regard to pooling.
I need to ask you one other question. We've sometimes required that for that to be a fiduciary relationship in a particular factual situation which is not characterized as a special relationship like attorney-client. There must be some prior relationship between the parties. Do you meet that requirement in this case?
As one in 64, 60, 64.
Because of the separate agreements.
Yes.
And you would argue that the separate agreements satisfy that condition even though the working relationship continued over the years.
Yes, sir.
Were these agreements for set terms of years, or did they change them when there were new
They will change them occasionally, but each was envisioned to be in perpetuity unless they changed.
Okay.
And I will now yield the amicus if there are no further questions.
May it please the court, my name is David Coffey. I represent three friends of the court who have asked for an opportunity to be heard. Those include the Texas Auto Dealers Association, the National Auto Dealers Association, and then a trade group that represents tractor dealers and farm equipment dealers. Now, all of these industries operate under franchise agreements, which are substantially identical to the one or to the act, to the agreements that were at issue in this case. So there's a fair amount of industry interest in how you decide this issue of whether or not some sort of informal fiduciary relationship or an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing or a special relationship arises out of these types of contracts.
Is this a standard provision in these types of contracts?
It is a very standard provision, Your Honor. Most of these agreements will, as I tried to point out in my brief, vest all of the express contractual control and authority over the relationship in the manufacturer, and yet on the other hand, they will hold out these expressions of mutual benefit, mutual good, the common good, as being the underlying goal of the relationship. So I think that really is the underlying reason why we think it's appropriate to apply some sort of higher duty to these types of relationships, because it's unconscionable, I believe, and it simply is not equitable for a manufacturer to essentially induce someone to enter into a relationship with him, make a truly substantial investment in that relationship while holding out that the underlying goal of the relationship will be the common good. If he's going to retain that kind of power over the relationship, then there ought to be a higher duty that he exercise that with at least some regard, some fairness towards the interest of the weaker party.
Why doesn't the written contract protect franchisee sufficiently?
They just don't have the bargaining leverage, quite frankly, to negotiate any express terms of control into the contract. That's one of the identifiable elements, I think, that this court...
Is it a matter of control, or is it a matter of what damages are maybe available for the breach of that agreement?
Well, it's really a matter of control, I think. None of these contracts, and very few contracts, are really going to involve liquidated damages type provisions. It's really an element of control. Does the weaker party to the contract have some kind of express right under the contract to defend the benefit that he's bargained for? He has bargained for a relationship of mutual benefit and common good. That's what he invested in. On the other hand, the dominant party to the relationship has retained all the express control by virtue of his superior bargaining position.
Almost everybody hopes the other side will use good faith. Almost every contract involves someone with somewhat superior bargaining power.
Well, I think that's correct.
Why does your argument go too far?
No, sir. You're right. There is always going to be an imbalance of bargaining power in every relationship. It really depends upon the degree to which there's an imbalance. And in this particular type of relationship where you have a multinational corporation, which over a period of 60 or 70 years has refined the written contract down to the point where it addresses every single conceivable aspect and facet of the relationship and gives them a lever of control over every single facet of that relationship, then I think we look at a situation where equity needs to step in, imply a higher duty, as this court has always done under its traditional informal fiduciary analysis, that where you see these identifiable elements, the imbalance of bargaining power where it's sufficient enough, absolutely pervasive control in one party, and an inadequate remedy for the abusive use of that control, then it's appropriate to imply a special relationship and engraft on that the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. And that's really what we're asking for. We don't really think this is a true fiduciary type duty. We really don't. We don't think the manufacturer should be held to a true fiduciary type standard. They have legitimate reasons for wanting a greater element of control over the relationship than the weaker party has. They really do have legitimate reasons. So it's not. We don't think that they should be held to the utmost highest duty of good faith and fair dealing. We simply think that there should be engrafted onto this some legal mechanism, some higher duty of fairness, if you will, so that the weaker party has some opportunity to obtain some economic redress for the injury that occurs as a result of the abusive use of the power. Well, I think the Arnold standard is probably the appropriate standard. What you articulated in that case was a duty of care and prudence, the same type of care and prudence towards the other party's interest as you would show towards your own business. I believe that's
a golden rule.
Well, I think that is a golden rule. I think that is one way of expressing the golden rule in a contractual relationship.
I take it you're not suggesting, however, the facts of this case might not support the finding of the fiduciary relationship.
No, sir, I think the facts in this case do support it, and I would point out that in every case that I've seen where you've addressed this issue and declined to imply the duty of good faith and fair dealing, you've done so under this traditional analysis because you didn't see one of those identifiable elements. I would point to the Coors versus Rodriguez case that you recently denied writ in. The lower court in that case had basically said, we don't see the pervasive control element in this case. And in fact, looking at the evidence, we don't see any evidence whatsoever that even if a duty existed, that it's been breached in this case. You were put out of business by macroeconomic forces that the manufacturer had no control over. We're simply saying, and I think this gets back to...
I think we got your point.
Okay.
Are there any other questions?
I'd like to know, are you saying that breach of contract damages are inadequate to make the franchisee whole in these circumstances, such that this court ought to engraft an additional duty here, so as to allow tort damages?
Yes, sir, I am saying that this court should engraft a higher tort duty on this type of relationship.
Why are contract damages inadequate to make the franchisee whole?
I don't know that I'm necessarily saying that contract damages are inadequate in this particular case. Typically, when a franchisee gets put out of business, his investment gets extinguished, and that investment will include the purchase of the property if he owns the property, the building that he has built out of his own pocket, investment in machinery, equipment, personnel, training. These investments can run into hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars. I don't really know what the actual damages in this case were, but it is perhaps possible that in an appropriate case, contractual damages would be adequate.
Let me ask you a question. Do you see the same type of imbalance of bargaining power, lack of ability to create your own contract, lack of remedy between your clients and the consuming public that they deal with?
Yes, sir. I think there is the same imbalance of bargaining power.
So if we were to create this duty, we would need to look at a similar duty that you would owe to people who bought your product.
Your Honor, I think what you're saying is there a similar type duty that a merchant owes to a consumer? And I think clearly there is. And I think there's some analogy between the merchant-consumer relationship and the franchise relationship that we're dealing with here. The dealer is essentially the purchaser of the manufacturer's product. He is the only main source of for someone to buy his product. He sells it to the dealer. The dealer finances it through a credit arm of the manufacturer and then hopefully resells it to the public at a profit. So there is, I think, a consumer aspect to this whole relationship. So it's not that difficult for me to take the implied duty that you typically engraft onto that type of merchant-consumer relationship and to and go ahead and impute it to the manufacturer-dealer relationship as well. Yes, I think that the same duty should be engrafted onto the relationship between my clients and the consumers as we're asking you to engraft onto this relationship. I think it's already
any
there.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May I please report?
May it please the Court, Your Honors. The issue, as I understand it, that the Court is principally interested in is whether the Court of Appeals erred in holding as a matter of law that there was no fiduciary relationship between Trim Truck and Tractor and my client, Navistar International Transportation Corporation. There are two issues that I think are not in this case, and both of which have been alluded to in the arguments that preceded me. One is whether a fiduciary duty was established as a matter of law. The plaintiffs did not argue that they had established a duty as a matter of law. They requested that it be submitted to the jury. They made no post-trial objections or motions arguing that it was established as a matter of law, nor did they argue that in the Court of Appeals. The first time that contention was made was in the motion for rehearing filed in the Court of Appeals. So I contend there's no procedural predicate for this court to rule that there is a duty as a matter of law. Second, Amicus argues that this court should consider implying a duty of good faith and fair dealing into the relationship between manufacturers and dealers. That issue also was expressly presented in the trial court and expressly abandoned and waived by the petitioners in the trial court. Their live pleading at trial pleaded a theory of implied duty, an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. At the charge conference, counsel withdrew his request for an issue on that. The charge does not mention it anywhere, nor has the argument been made by petitioners anywhere in this case that there ought to be an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing. What distinguishes a fiduciary duty from other higher duties at common law is essentially this, that a fiduciary must always place the interests of the party to whom the duty is owed above his own. That's essentially what this court has said in the past, the fiduciary duty means. So the question is, here, did the plaintiffs introduce any evidence from which a jury, a fact finder, could have found that Navistar, either through the contract or otherwise, placed the interests of the dealer ahead of its own
should
in this relationship?
Should have placed.
No, I think it is did, Your Honor. Not should have, but
so
did
they
do
so? So if an attorney is not willing to owe a proper duty to his client, we don't imply it under the law?
And I think that is a question of a breach of duty. There's no question that an attorney, as a matter of law, that is a formal fiduciary relationship, and there's no issue that needs to be submitted to a jury. The question here is of an informal fiduciary relationship. So the evidence has to be looked at in the light of, does the facts that are in the record and that are pointed to by the petitioners suggest that Navistar undertook a duty or had a special fiduciary relationship?
Well, what about the contracts in 1964 and 60 and 79 that said this is a personal obligation?
Your Honor, there is a provision in the contract. It is in the assignment provision. It says this being a contract of mutual trust and confidence, it cannot be assigned by either party. That is the language that the plaintiffs have pointed to. This court has said as long ago as in Thigpen against Locke that parties dealing with one another in a commercial relationship naturally are expected to have trust and confidence in one another, and said that alone is not enough. Subjective expressions of trust and confidence, whether they're oral or in a contract, are simply no evidence of a fiduciary duty, not just a duty of trust and confidence, but a duty to put the interests of the other party above one's own. The Fifth Circuit recently reaffirmed and followed this court's ruling in Thigpen in the Crawford drywall case and said language just like this was no evidence of a fiduciary duty. Let me add as well the Court of Appeals mentioned, it's mentioned in the petitioner's brief, that Mr. Krim testified that he relied on this language in the contract when he signed it. He would not have signed this contract but for the fact it had this clause down in paragraph 30, the assignment clause, that said this being a contract of mutual trust and confidence. The evidence is that Mr. Krim didn't sign this contract, nor did he see it, nor did he read it. His partner, Mr. Farley, did. And if you look at the contract in the record, Mr. Krim's signature isn't on it. Mr. Farley testified that he skimmed over it before signing it. There's no evidence in the record that Mr. Krim saw it or read it before it was signed by International Harvester and by Mr. Farley, his partner.
The Fifth Circuit case that you cited a moment ago, is that in your brief?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It's the Crawford drywall case, and it is in our brief. The first thing I think the court has to look at in examining whether the evidence is evidence of a fiduciary relationship is the nature of the relationship itself, and all your cases say that. What type of relationship is this? Is it familial? Is it social? Is it domestic? Those are the areas where fiduciary duty has been most commonly found. This relationship is contractual. It has been contractual from the very beginning. It has never been anything but contractual, governed by the terms of written contracts that, contrary to Amicus's argument to the contrary, have been changed over the years to improve the terms, make them more favorable to the dealers. Amicus's brief suggested that the most pernicious power retained by the manufacturer was to terminate these contracts without cause. Well, it is true the 1964 contract, which is in evidence in this case, but was not the contract that was litigated by the parties, or the one that was in effect, had that provision. But between 1964 and 1979, when the new contract, the one that was litigated by these parties, was signed, Navistar had been persuaded by the dealers to change that, and the contract did not allow termination except for specified causes. And in fact, that is what the issue that was submitted to the jury on breach of contract is, whether the reason argued by Navistar was within the causes permitted by the contract. And I've attached an appendix to my pre-submission brief which illustrates numerous changes over the years favorable to the dealers between the 1964 and the 1979 contract.
Under what circumstances should the existence of the fiduciary duty be submitted to a jury?
And I think, obviously, I argued in this case that there was no evidence to submit the issue to the jury. I didn't think it should have been submitted
be
in this case. No, I don't.
Fiduciary relationship between the franchisor and franchisee?
I think it is going to be an extremely rare case in which there could be a fiduciary duty owed by a franchisor to a franchisee just by the nature of the relationship. I don't say it's impossible.
How would that be different? Can you give us an example of some of the circumstances which may give rise to a fact question of a fiduciary duty under a franchisor-franchisee relationship, understanding it's your position that they did not exist here?
I think there would have to be facts of the type, for example, that the Consolidated Gas case discusses, where there was a long history. Maybe the franchisor has some sort of familiar or domestic relation with the franchisee, or there's no written contract, or it's done on an informal basis. The Thigpen against Locke case is actually a good example, although the court there ultimately found no fiduciary duty, where someone had come in and basically sort of taken over running someone else's business. And after a long period of time, the person whose business was being run argued, I had a right to rely on the fact that this person was going to look out after my interest. But in the sort of arm's length contractual relationship that typically exists when what we talk about a franchisee-franchisor relationship, I think it would be very hard to create a jury issue without a whole lot more than is present here.
So a contract is a negative indicia of a fiduciary relationship.
The case is so hold, and I think that's true. It's the nature of the relationship. If the parties have at least enough bargaining power to order their relationships by contract, then the courts are less inclined to find the sort of heightened trust, heightened reliance that typically is found in
what you're saying here. This is not a freely bargained for contract, as I understand. It's a take it or leave it by Navistar, but their dealers exercise collective pressure to have these terms changed.
Well,
periodically, is that what, does the record show that? seems that's what you're saying.
Yes, I think the record does show that. The contracts over the years, there's a 63, a 64, and a 79 contract in the record, and it does show that the terms consistently got more favorable to the dealers. I don't think there's any evidence in the record that this is a take-it-or-leave-it proposition. Mr. Krim did say that. Now, manufacturers, because they deal with a lot of dealers, are under an obligation not to discriminate. I mean, they can't go in and negotiate completely separate contracts with each dealer. So the forms are typically, they're presented to the dealer. The dealer wants to have a relationship with the manufacturer, then they're asked to sign this form.
But it sounds like take it or leave it.
Look, but the forms do change. The dealers,
are there individual, was there any evidence in the record that there were individual changes between one dealer and the next?
There was no evidence of contracts with other dealers. There were evidence of end of changes in this contract. In other words, what products would be sold, there were addenda and so on presented. But the basic form of the contract is, and really needs to be by law, consistent between the dealers. What the record does show very clearly is that the form of contract has become increasingly more favorable to the dealers, at least as of 1979, when the contract that was an issue in the case was entered into. And there's another factor in this issue of control. Excuse me, yes, Justice.
How has it become more favorable to the dealers with respect to their rights in the event the manufacturer wants to cancel the contract?
In this particular case, the 1964 contract provided that it could be terminated without cause upon giving, I believe, 90 days notice. In 1971, the Texas Motor Vehicle Commission Code was enacted, which provided that a manufacturer could not terminate a, notwithstanding the provision of any franchise agreement to the contrary, a manufacturer could not terminate a franchise such as this or an agreement such as this if the dealer didn't want them to, if they protested, without going down to the commission and proving good cause in an evidentiary hearing to the commission. By 1979, the contract in issue in this case, the termination provision, said that there was no termination without cause, that the manufacturer had to have certain specified causes before the contract could be terminated. In this case, the jury found that Navistar did not have one of those specified causes.
So you're saying that you could devise some kind of boilerplate expressions of high regard for one another and so forth that would put into a contract a fiduciary relationship, but no matter how many times they said similar type stuff in this contract, that was not did not create a fiduciary.
I'm saying this sort of expression was not the type of expression
no
that would create a fiduciary.
No matter where it appeared in the contract or how often repeated, it was sort of puff talk.
I'm not saying it was puff talk. It is an important part of the contract. What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that it is not an expression of a fiduciary duty. If the contract said, dealer, you can count on us in the case of termination or exercise of any of our other rights to put your interests before our own, that would obviously create a formal contractual fiduciary relationship. And that is, in essence, what has led every court in this country that has addressed the issue to hold that the that a franchisee-franchisor relationship is not a fiduciary.
Let's go beyond the typical franchise agreement, because as I understand, the plaintiffs are just arguing here that they're not asking us to impose, as a matter of law, a fiduciary relationship in every franchise agreement. But once you take the factors in Justice Grant's dissent, where he finds there is some evidence under the unique facts of this case that there is a fiduciary relationship. And what in the factors enumerated by Justice Grant, you say this amounts to no evidence of a fiduciary relationship under the facts of this case?
Yes, I have those six factors listed here, Your Honor. The first is the contract language, which Thigpen against Locke says is no evidence of a fiduciary relationship. Second, he says Mr. Krim testified that he relied on that contract language. Again, the evidence was that Mr. Krim didn't sign the contract, never saw it. Third, the relationship lasted 42 years. There's no question that's a fact. The relationship lasted 42 years. This court's own cases have made clear that the duration of the relationship standing alone is no evidence of a fiduciary relationship. You'll go back to the Consolidated Gas case, and they describe what length of, that's where this doctrine originated. And what they said there was if the parties had acted as fiduciaries to one another over a long period of time in prior relationships, then in the relationship before the court, that would be evidence that this one was also fiduciary. And that's all that doctrine means. And there's not a shred of evidence in this record that Navistar ever acted as a fiduciary, put the dealer's interest above its own, where the two conflicted in the past. The common goal, he says there was a common goal to sell trucks. Well, you know, there's no question you enter into a franchise agreement. The dealer wants to sell trucks to make money. The manufacturer wants to sell trucks to make money. The fiduciary duty cases do not say that type of common end creates a fiduciary duty. What they say is like in the partnership context or the joint venture context.
How about the building, the special buildings, changing location, the computer system, and everything that's done at the request of your client?
The prototype,
in addition to the others that we've talked about.
The prototype building was built in 1947. That's when that happened. And it was done at the dealer's, the testimony was the dealer wanted to erect a building. He didn't have a permanent location in Henderson, and so he built a building. Navistar paid for an advertisement in the paper that said, congratulations on building your prototype building as a symbol of permanency and good faith in the community of Henderson. And I fail to see how congratulating your dealer on making a commitment or sending down roots in his community is any indication that you're going to put the dealer's interest above your own when exercising your contract rights. Finally, the two computer systems, Justice Grant simply made a mistake there. There's no evidence that they had purchased two computer systems. The relevant exchange occurs on page 37 of the statement of facts. A witness was asked, didn't Navistar have two computer systems called DADS and SPIMS before this one? The witness said yes. He said, didn't Krim have those? The witness said, I haven't any idea. That's the evidence. There is no evidence in this record that they had ever bought any computer systems. And in fact, if you look at the evidence cited for the statement that the Krim always abided by the wishes of Navistar, the record reference for that is page 184 and 185 in the statement of facts. And what Mr. Krim testifies there is that whenever Navistar came out with a new line of products, because at one time Navistar sold appliances and agricultural equipment and other things as trucks, they would try to sell those too. That's what his testimony was about always abiding by the wishes of Navistar. Again, I fail to see how that is any evidence. It's a fact. He said those things, but I don't see that that is any evidence that Navistar undertook a fiduciary duty to Krim Truck and Tractor. So having addressed every one of those things, now the last thing that Justice Grant says in his sentence, he talks about looking at the terms of the franchise agreement, Navistar had dominance over Krim Truck and Tractor. And there's no question, I've said this in my pre-submission brief, by virtue of being in the position of the manufacturer who controls the supply of the product, the manufacturer is always going to have a better bargaining position economically than the dealer because they have control of the supply. They've used that power, there's no question about it, to negotiate the very best contract terms for themselves that they have been able to get away with. What the record also shows is that they have not been able, that increasingly they've not been able to get away with any of it. Virtually every substantive provision in the franchise agreement between Navistar and Krim Truck and Tractor has been legislatively reversed. In the Texas Motor Vehicle Commission Code, your amicus brief lists 18 things that the manufacturer can't do or say in a franchise agreement. Provision after provision, notwithstanding anything in the franchise agreement, to the contrary, a manufacturer may not. And every one of those things, it is totally misleading to look at this franchise agreement and take it in isolation from the total context of the manufacturer-dealer relationship in Texas today. Manufacturers in Texas today are on the run if they're not totally routed by the forces of the dealers acting collectively and politically, and as I said in my brief, perfectly properly. No one's suggesting that's wrong. But the dealers have organized extremely effectively to reverse legislatively the economic advantage that manufacturers have in their relationship, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm sure the manufacturers would do it if they could. They can't. The dealers are local. There are lots of them in Texas. They have a lot of political influence in Texas, and they've been able to convince the legislature, and properly, that their interests ought to be protected. And as I say, it is one of the Carter case, the Carter Equipment Company case, cited by both Amicus and the petitioners for, and it's one of the only cases, in fact, the only case, it's a Fifth Circuit case, 1982, that construing Mississippi law, which says that there can maybe be a fiduciary duty flowing between a franchisor and a franchisee. And it says, right after the statement quoted by petitioners and Amicus about looking at the differential bargaining power, it says it's critical, however, to look at the bargaining power of both sides, not just the franchisor, but the franchisee as well. And I submit if the court does that and looks at not just what this franchise agreement says, but what the dealers have been able to persuade the legislature to do to that franchise agreement in the Texas Motor Vehicle Commission Code, there will be no basis for this court to be concerned that the dealers need even further protection, some special common law duty in their relationship with the manufacturers. My time has expired. Any questions?
Thank you, Kevin.
Your Honor, you're aware of your position in the Texas judiciary. It's been characterized as you guard justice. I don't know the history of the Texas Motor Vehicle Commission Code. I don't know what law exists now. I'm a trial lawyer from Henderson, Texas. I can tell you that under the undisputed record of this case, International Harvester absolutely economically devastated my clients. And that's what I'm here about.
Can you explain why breach of contract damages would not make your client whole?
I wrote that down, Justice Cornyn, about your question earlier, and I'll tell you in this case, it's undisputed in the record of this case that Freedom Truck and Tractor, when they built the building, built it to the specifications of International Harvester. It is an International Harvester building. The service phase, the way it's laid out, all set in concrete, steel, it can't be changed. That's all you can use it for. And that's an economic, and the record, that's $350,000 worth of money.
Why can't you bring a John Deere or a Case or some other?
All county seat, as a practical matter, all county seat towns already have those dealers in them. See, the other part is,
if they didn't, you could bring one in. There's nothing particular about this building that could not be used by some other.
It would have to be used for, you know, the truck or for that type of number. You could put another one in, yes, if you all could. Right. But now, view this against the backdrop, though. The record in the case shows that used to International Harvester marketing, and this is in the record of the case, their marketing strategy was be in every county seat town and have somebody to go into this fiduciary relationship with you, this mutual confidence and trust, and market your product. Then they started changing it to saying, we only have 99 dealers nationwide, but here 1999, and they just started eliminating these people. And they used the pretext in this case of buying a computer system that they were getting kickbacks on to terminate CREM, and even the Texas County Court said, well, they terminated them for no good reason as part of this marketing strategy. And so, while we can talk about TMBC, I want to, in the record of this case, if you read it, it's a very emotional case because of what they did to my clients. And I don't want us to get too far away from that. They used an excuse and a pretext to terminate a dealer after 43 years.
Is there any way you believe a manufacturer should be able to change market strategy without responding to actual punitive damage?
As long as they don't violate their own contracts and as long as they don't violate a trust that they set out, they ought to be able to do it. But the one thing,
How would you not violate a trust if this is someone's life's work and they've built it?
If you write it into the contract, say up front, when these people put your money up, that if we change our marketing strategy, that's one way we can terminate you as a result of marketing strategy, and everybody accepts that going in, that's fine. But that's not what they did. They used an excuse and a pretext to do it.
Under this contract, though, if they decided they didn't want to sell to anybody in Texas anymore, would you say that they, if they had, would still be held to your contract?
Yes, sir. If they could use their economic clout to make it disadvantageous for us to do that.
Counsel, to the left of that language you have displayed there, it says parties bound effect of partial invalidity and assignment. Opposing counsel said this language was inserted in there to prevent you from assigning your interest under the contract. Would you respond to that, please?
Yes. Justice Cook, last case, made a very good point. Parties are intended to know the effects of the words that they use and the actions that they take. And if International Harvester writes contract language that says this involves mutual confidence and trust and uses the dictionary definition of fiduciary, wherever they use it, they define the relationship that they've had for all these many years with the manufacturer, between the manufacturer and the seller.
Even if it was intended to prevent your client from assigning their interest in the contract?
This parenthetical expression, or this expression set out by commas, is there not for the purpose, it's in the clause that does that. They're attempting here to define the agreement and the type of agreement that it is. And they are presumed to have known the effect of the words that they use, regardless of the position of it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your
Honor. That completes the argument in the third clause. The foregoing causes are all submitted to the court on briefs and oral arguments. That concludes the business of the court for the day.